History of Persia is a Hopful Media podcast production.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
This is the place where Black is the main character, where we dive into something new like the latest season of Them, The Scare, and the award-winning American Fiction. Or add to the experience by buying or renting the biopic of a legend, Bob Marley, One Love. And add on channels like Paramount Plus and Stars to bask in nostalgia with Beverly Hills Cop and BMF. Explore Prime Video's culture-rated collection and enjoy old-school greats and new-school hits. Restrictions apply. See Amazon.com/Amazon Prime for details.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the History of Persia. I'm Trevor Cully, and this is the long-awaited episode 125, Ask Me Anything Again. Now, this is later than I wanted it to come out for a variety of reasons. When I intended to originally record this, we got a sudden cool weekend here in Missouri, and I devoted several days to gardening before summer hits and burns me out of house and home. Then we were racked by apocalyptic thunderstorms for about a week, and I recorded an attic, so that wasn't going to work. But now, might I say, wow. 125 episodes. Going on 200, if you include announcements, bonus episodes, interviews, etc. I cannot have asked for a better audience. But, have y'all ever considered that you, the listener, are too smart? A lot of content creators do question and answer episodes, and they get stuff about the basics of their field or funny personal bits like, what did you have for breakfast? The answer, by the way, is Highland Grog coffee with a splash of walnut milk and one pump of vanilla syrup. But you, the listeners of this podcast, asked tons of deep, thoughtful, interesting questions that demand equally compelling answers. And I had already planned on making this into 2 episodes, but I suspect it will yet balloon out of control into 3. On that note, if your question is not answered in this episode, and you submitted it before Monday, April 29th, 2024, rest assured, it will be answered soon. There are a few that I decided in advance would fit the second AMA episode coming in a couple weeks. So, with that disclaimer out of the way, let's answer some questions. Starting with a pair asking about things that I neglected to mention in all of those episodes about Alexander the Great, despite intending to bring them up. So, Matthew asked, if I remember correctly, in your Tour of the Empire episodes, you mentioned that some communities of Greeks were deported and resettled in the East, fairly early in the Achaemenid era. What are they up to? Did they survive to interact in any interesting ways with the newer Greeks and Macedonians arriving? So part of the reason that I neglected to mention this is because I am actually planning an episode on exactly this topic, either as a bonus or as one of the topical episodes between now and episode 126 proper. But, in brief, many, many Greeks were resettled in the Persian Empire over the years, beginning very early on. A few cities, like Priene, were actually sacked and had large numbers of people deported, or as Herodotus says, enslaved, elsewhere in the empire by Cyrus the Great's generals during the original conquest of Ionia. Under Darius the Great, many Greeks were taken to the east. When the satrap Aryandes invaded Libya, he sacked the city of Barca, and Herodotus says that the Barcaeans were taken to Bactria. This particular incident has been debated, though frankly, I don't really understand why, other than the usual grudge some historians hold against Herodotus. Like I said, it's not a unique phenomenon. The Ionian Revolt also yielded many examples. Specifically, Herodotus describes how the people of Miletus were deported for leading the rebellion, and that some Eritreans were deported to a town near Susa and put to work collecting bitumen as part of their punitive campaign that ended in Marathon. Darius's inscription DSF, which describes the construction of his palace at Susa, references Greeks transporting wood from Assyria, not a particularly Greek region. That suggests that either Greek prisoners transported the wood, or they had already been resettled in northern Mesopotamia before the palace was constructed. Likewise, Greeks also appear as Kirtash workers in the Persepolis archive tablets, presumably prisoners of war deported to, at least temporarily, work as manual labor around the palace complex. And all of this continued through the wars between Greece and Persia, although the final destination of the deportees usually is not documented. This system of deporting rebellious or particularly hard-to-conquer populations was very old, a practice pioneered by the Assyrians centuries earlier, and most famously enacted against the people of Israel and Judah. In most cases, these deported groups appear to have assimilated within a few generations. That said, Alexander did have two notable encounters. The first was at Persepolis, where Alexander found several hundred Greek men working as enslaved or convict laborers, many with amputations dealt out as punishment for unspecified infractions by the Persians. These men were relatively recent arrivals who still had immediate family alive back home, but they had also been there long enough to form relationships and even marriages with local people or other prisoners deported in Parsa. They were probably captives taken during the wars of Artaxerxes II and III, or even maybe Philip II's initial Macedonian invasion. On Alexander's arrival, the king offered to send them home, but it had been long enough that some of the Greek captives worried about disrupting the lives of family who had already moved on, and abandoning their own new families. Most of them chose to resettle in some of Alexander's newly founded cities and colonies in Western Asia. The second encounter was in Bactria, where Alexander encountered a group of people that Curtius calls the Bronchidae, which links them back to a clan of priests from Miletus. Some of the Ionian Bronchidae were likely deported 170 years earlier, and it's possible that their name just became the general identity of their descendants and the descendants of other Greek deportees in Bactria. Curtius describes a massacre of the Bronchidae on the basis that their forebears had sided with Xerxes during his invasion, which the invading army may have believed, but the most notable deportation from Miletus was also before that, and most historians doubt the story, even questioning if a distinct Greco-Bactrian subculture existed before Alexander arrived. Finally, in a proclamation celebrating the Olympic Games of 324 BCE, Alexander issued a general amnesty for all Greek exiles, allowing them to return to their homes whether they were expelled by their own city's government or forcibly taken by the Persians, which at least suggests that he was aware of a wider diaspora, though we don't get further details. Alex said, in episode 113, I mentioned in passing that the Greek sources acknowledge that Alexander openly targeted the Brahmin religious caste in India. Alex was wondering if I could speak more about this. What form did this take, and is there any sense of what motivated it? He also mentioned that his mother-in-law has told him about legends of Sikander, who has a reputation of being a wise and benevolent king, so he was surprised to learn about the brutality that marked Alexander's Indian campaign. I will address the second part first here. There were basically two memories of Alexander that survived in Iran, or possibly one that survived and one that was imported in late antiquity. The first is the harsh Zoroastrian interpretation of the accursed Iskandar. The second is a form of the so-called Alexander romance, stories of fantasy and daring do that portray Alexander as a mythological hero. The latter is the version portrayed in the Shahnameh's Iskander, which, like the Shahnameh more generally, became the more influential version in Persianate literature, including most of the traditions brought over to India across the centuries. The role of the Brahmin caste in Greek literature is, admittedly, quite confused. Some Greco-Roman authors apparently thought that the Varnas were separate tribes of people. Some use Brahmin as a generic word for Indian philosophers. Others seem to use it as semi-accurately, initially in Taxila. Several accounts described by Strabo show Alexander being vaguely curious about Indian beliefs. However, several other accounts identify the Brahmin as one of the groups that challenged Alexander during his war with the Malians. In the latter case, it seems that the Brahmins in the Malian and Oxydrachi societies were specifically targeted. But because the ancient historians themselves don't use very clear terminology, it can be hard to actually say more than that. As the Greeks typically understood it, Brahmins were the advisors to Indian kings, which is not wholly inaccurate in the 4th century BCE, but it is vastly underselling the role of a hereditary priesthood. That said, the aspect of being leaders and organizers in communities that resisted Alexander's conquest is the most obvious explanation for why the Brahmins would be identified as enemies in some sources. And unlike the Magi in Persia, Indian Brahmins were often more directly attached to political power and roles of political prestige. Now, moving on to some more general questions. Mikhail said, ancient empires led campaigns, a lot of them. There was even something like a campaigning season. But were all these campaigns violent? Or were there instances where the King of Kings gathered an army, walked through his own empire, just to remind the subjects who's boss and fix up any potential tax or tribute evasion? So, on one hand, I suppose something like this happened all the time, though it usually wasn't framed that way. if the Great King went anywhere, he traveled with at least a few thousand armed men, including the Royal Guard, Herodotus's immortals, as well as his noble cavalry companions. The difference between the Royal Guard and a small army with its baggage train and camp followers was more a difference in attitude than anything else. So, since the Achaemenid kings traveled between multiple capital cities throughout the year, and would occasionally leave those main palaces in Persepolis, Susa, Babylon, and Ecbatana to visit still more palaces, they marched around like this and reminded everyone in the heartland of the king's presence a few times a year. Now, the King of Kings himself wouldn't usually travel much into the outer provinces unless it was an actual war, but records from Persepolis and anecdotal accounts from various Greek authors do make it clear that other members of the royal family traveled all over, either as satraps or on other business. And when they did travel, these Persian royals would take their own retinue like a smaller version of the royal court, including an armed contingent. And they would have a similar effect, reminding everyone they passed who was in charge and who held the power. We also know from various records, like those found at the temples in Elephantine, the writings of Xenophon, Babylonian records of all sorts, and the Persepolis archives, that there were small garrisons of soldiers dotted all over. So if there was any sort of local conflict or tax evasion, there was a force of Persian soldiers, or more accurately, soldiers recruited from around the empire nearby to act as a sort of rapid response to smaller incidents. Think on the order of a few dozen to maybe a couple hundred people instead of armies of tens of thousands like we get in the more dramatic war stories. Mikhail followed this up with two more connected questions. One, who supplied the army on the move through friendly territory? Was it funded from the king's treasury, or maybe it was the duty of the satrap that governed a particular province? Or did the soldiers need to care for themselves? So, if you want more information on this, I will actually drop a link in the episode description to a big write-up I did on exactly this topic in the Ask Historians subreddit. On an individual level, soldiers in ancient armies often did things to take care of themselves, going out in small foraging parties or hunting parties to collect enough for their own little group to supplement their more basic rations. But broadly speaking, when you're moving tens and tens of thousands of soldiers, you do need more logistics than that. Especially in friendly territory, water was easy to manage, because most of the well-traveled routes through the empire were along major rivers or mountain ranges that had streams from snowmelt. When crossing between these areas, armies would usually encamp near major cities, which had their own water sources for the soldiers to resupply. Within the empire, food was available from official storehouses maintained full-time by the satraps. When they moved larger bodies of troops, or even the royal court, it would never be a spur-of-the-moment thing. That meant that cities and towns along the way would receive orders from the king or their satrap in advance to set aside food for the army. The largest armies, like Xerxes' invasion force on its way to Greece, would typically divide their forces in friendly territory so as not to burden any one region beyond its capacity. Typically, if the army was en route during the winter, when supplies were more scarce, they would break up even further and install small garrisons for the season all over the satrapy they were in. The food and other supplies set aside for the army was treated like part of the tax burden, much like military service itself, corvée labor, or taxation paid in the form of goods rather than currency, all things that I've talked about plenty of times on this show. An important detail to remember here is that even though the Achaemenids could muster 100,000 to 200,000 soldiers, that was unusual. Normally, there were only a few tens of thousands who would be under arms across the entire empire. Also from Mikal, was a friendly army a threat for local people? I guess they would not burn a city, but perhaps they would steal food or harass women. In a word, yes. This was, and is still today, such a common aspect of armies, whether in friendly territory or not, that ancient authors tend to only mention it in passing. But it absolutely is mentioned. If you get a few thousand people together with weapons, authority, and a sense of duty, some of them will abuse that position. It is just a factor of armies for as long as we've had recorded history. In particular, I'm thinking about the first book of Xenophon's Anabasis, where they reference several instances of nominally friendly cities either not having enough supplies or not wanting to cooperate with Cyrus the Younger's supply collectors, and this leading to small outbreaks of violence as the soldiers tried to resupply from the unwilling townspeople. Next, I have a couple of questions from Ilva, who asked, how impactful have the Achaemenids been on popular culture in modern Iran? Is it slash has it been a common era to depict in movies and TV shows, depending on how conservative the government is? Ilva added that the story of Bardia is so outrageous it would make for a great TV show or a soap opera. Now, of course, I agree with you, but pop culture all over the world hasn't really caught on yet. In the US and Europe, pop culture around the Achaemenids focuses almost entirely on the wars of Alexander the Great or Xerxes, either as a character in the biblical story of Esther or the invasion of Greece. In Iran, when the Achaemenids have made it into cinemas, it is almost always Cyrus the Great. But in the last 45 years, the situation has been especially fraught, and the Iranian film industry has been heavily censored. Under Mohammad Reza Shah, ancient history, and the Achaemenids in particular, featured prominently in the Iranian government's propaganda. This is when you get films about Cyrus and occasionally Darius or Xerxes. Following the Islamic Revolution in 1979, there was a backlash against this, to the degree that some clerics in the new government wanted to destroy sites like Persepolis and Pasargadae. Promoting or valorizing pre-Islamic kings was censored for most of the next 20 years. More recently, the 2016 Cyrus the Great Day Revolt resurrected the Achaemenids as a symbol of resistance in Iranian pop culture, but with heavy media censorship, the Achaemenids are not making it into Iranian cinemas anytime soon. Also from Ilva, why were the Persians so adamant on conquering the Greeks? What would they gain besides some rocky islands? Are there some natural resources I'm not aware of, or was it prestige, like the Greeks are annoying and fight back, let's conquer them? Right. When Darius and Xerxes started campaigning into Europe, there were two major draws to Greece and the Balkan coast in general. First, they had significant mineral wealth. Attica and northern Greece had large silver mines. The northern coast had gold and silver. That's an obvious attraction. The other aspect of Greece that appealed to the Persians was its role in trade. Like Phoenicia, the Greeks had colonies and trade routes stretching all the way to the Atlantic. But also, if you look at a map of the Western Persian Empire, Greece is an obvious gaping hole in their sphere of power. Trade goods and money flowed through both the mainland and the Aegean islands, including a lot of commerce coming out of Achaemenid territory, which went untaxed and unregulated. It was the last blot of independent, wealthy, urban trade hubs. Much like the Greeks' own colonies in Libyan Cyrenaica, mainland Greece itself marked the last point on the map before you had a large amount of territory controlled by mostly unsettled, unurbanized tribal peoples, before reaching places like Italy and Carthage further to the west, where the Persians couldn't really project power. There was a very natural cutoff point if you were looking to control the civilized, quote-unquote, world just to the west of Greece, but Greece was still within their reach. After the Ionian Revolt, and certainly by the time of kings like Darius II and Artaxerxes II, it was also a matter of prestige. These were the people who resisted conquest. And later, the only people we know of who stole cities from the Persian Empire, not rebelled for their own liberation, but invaded from the outside and took territory to control themselves. Whether that was Athens or Sparta, it was an insult to Persian authority. Somebody on Twitter asked ages ago about what music I use for the ad transitions and the Hopful Media stinger at the beginning of each episode. I have since lost track of that tweet, but I will answer it here. It's just simple stock music I got from pond5.com. That's pond, like P-O-N-D, number 5.com. Literally titled Persian Music by It Showtime Music. No spaces between words. I'll put a link to that in the description. And on that note, you can listen to Persian Music right now because it is time for a break. I routinely wish that I knew more languages. Even right in the middle of the US, I run into Spanish speakers all the time, and my social media always has a little Persian, Arabic, some Dutch, and German. Rosetta Stone does help. It's the most trusted language learning program, after all. It's also conveniently available on desktop or on the go as an app, and has some really cool features that truly immerse you in the language you're learning. Just the first steps, like learning a new alphabet and some simple phrases, helped open new doors, and Rosetta Stone is a great choice as the trusted expert in this for 30 years and millions of users with 25 languages available to learn. They focus on fast language acquisition, without English translations, to help you learn, speak, listen, and think in your new language while building long-term retention. Their true accent speech recognition also gives feedback on pronunciation, which can be really important for languages like Persian, where how you say something is very important. And on top of being available for desktop and mobile, you have the option to download lessons and take them offline. This is also all available at a steal. You can get lifetime membership, all 25 languages, for 50% off. Don't put off learning that new language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, History of Persia listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today today. Thank you. Next, a question from Thomas. Which events / kings are you most looking forward to during the Seleucid period of the podcast? Well, one big thing is the Maccabee Revolt in Judea and the reign of Antiochus IV, aka Hanukkah's origin story. And I may or may not be trying much too hard to try and make that overlap with Hanukkah in a couple of years. That said, the thing I'm more excited to tell people about is the Fratarakha rulers of Persis, the semi-independent Persian monarchs during the Seleucid period. It's an area of history that is very, very poorly documented, but also presents some really interesting pieces of continuity from the Achaemenids into the future of Iranian history. And if I'm honest, that is the part that I'm still the most interested in, even as power shifts away to the Macedonian kings in Syria. On a related note, Nicholas asked, what about the next 100 or so episodes has already caught my interest for discussion? Would the Battle of Ecbatana and the conquests of Mithridates I and Phraates II of Parthia be too on the nose? I'm not going to rush, but I am excited to get away from these Greeks and into the Parthians, especially because that is the point where we really get some extended periods of time without a lot of Greek intervention. And I do think that will come right around episode 200. Of course, you all know me by now, and I'm very excited for a couple of religion topics in the near future, especially the Greek cult of Orpheus and its connections to Zervanite Zoroastrianism, because both of them get into some aspects of ancient philosophy and physics that a lot of people don't usually attribute to antiquity. Very mild spoiler, but you don't often get a lot of discussion about how ancient Greek people thought about the concept of time and space. And that was absolutely a connection and an idea that people were already thinking about 2,500 years ago. JV had two questions that I think actually have more or less the same answer. First, we don't have many or any records about the Achaemenids' eastern satrapies, let alone India, but what about the reverse? Do we have records about Iran or Central Asia from India? And if we have any, what is the ancient Indian view of ancient Iran, especially Zoroastrianism? The second part is, we have a lot of episodes about Iranian religion, culture, cuisine, and women, but as far as I remember, I don't think we have an episode about ancient Iranian philosophy. I wonder if we can have an episode about Iranian or maybe Mesopotamian philosophy. So the reason I haven't talked much about Indian perceptions of Iran or Iranian philosophy is because we really don't have enough sources to say anything. In fact, we don't have ancient Indian sources that discuss the Achaemenids at all. It's a genuinely bizarre absence that has left scholars of all stripes kind of scratching their heads for about 300 years now. There are a few references to invading peoples, most famously the Cambodia, who appear to be some kind of maybe Saka Scythian group in the Vedas, but nothing overlapping with this early period of Indo-Iranian history seems to be preserved in Indian sources. It's very Indus and, more importantly, Gangetic Valley-centric. Likewise, as I've said many times before, ancient Iran was not a particularly literary culture. Not that they were illiterate, but they didn't have grand works of written literature like we associate with Greece or Rome. So we have religious documentation, and we have the Avesta, largely preserved orally and written down in the Sassanid era of Iranian history, but we don't have the equivalent of an Iranian Aristotle or Socrates or something like that. There are hints of how Iranian beliefs influenced Greek philosophy that maybe I should get more into at some point, but we're also going to get into a lot more direct exposure with that in the Hellenistic period, which is why I have sort of been saving those topics. And on that note, both India and philosophy will become more and more relevant going forward, especially in a few years when we get to the Sassanid dynasty and the flourishing of Iranian literature for the first time. That said, even then, philosophy and religion were still deeply tied in ancient Iran, but treating them as separate topics like we do in Greece does become easier. A different question asker, TV, says, what's the deal with Alexander's horns, Zulkarnain? Have they got anything to do with the horns Moses is sometimes depicted with? Alright, for anybody out of the loop, in many depictions of Alexander the Great, especially those on coins minted after his death, Alexander has little curling ram's horns on the side of his head, kinda wrapping around his ear. These are meant to represent his divinity as a son of the Greco-Egyptian hybrid god Zeus Amon, revealed by the Oracle of Amun during the occupation of Egypt. Like many Egyptian gods, Amun was associated with animals, in his case a ram, and by this time, the end of the Egyptian late period, Amun was often depicted with ram's horns himself. These were likely an import from a similar god in the Nubian pantheon, which is why they don't usually appear in early Egyptian artwork. But that is what Alexander's horns are supposed to invoke, his divinity through Zeus Amon. Now, TV also mentioned Zulkarnain, which is a figure mentioned in the Quran, literally meaning the two-horned one, who is portrayed as a great conqueror on earth and a sign of the coming of Islam and/or the apocalypse. Traditionally, especially because of Alexander's horns and the whole world-conquering aspect of Zulkarnain, this is interpreted to be a reference to Alexander. That said, several other figures in Iranian and Arab history have also been suggested. Moses, on the other hand, is totally unrelated. For anybody who doesn't know, the biblical prophet and leader of the Hebrew Exodus from Egypt was frequently depicted with horns in medieval and Renaissance art. This is because, in the Bible, Moses is described as having a horned face when bringing God's commandments down from Mount Sinai. Except, that is probably a mistranslation or a misunderstanding of the original Hebrew when St. Jerome translated it into the Latin Vulgate. The Hebrew words karin and kurin are virtually identical in Hebrew script, which lacks vowels, and they are etymologically related, also related to the Arabic word al-karnain, now that I think about it. However, while Hebrew kuren literally means horns, karan means shining, as in rays of light shining like horns. But Greek and Latin translations simply used their own word for horn as the translation for centuries, stripping it of that important linguistic context that tells you it's probably not meant literally. It was only really during the Renaissance, when biblical scholars started returning to the original Hebrew, that this mistranslation was recognized, and you do start seeing depictions of Moses with rays of light in place of the horns from earlier artwork. Although, I'd also point out that not assuming Moses' horns were at least metaphorical in some way was always pretty silly, and I don't quite get how people interpreted that specific singular reference as literal horns. Moving on, Joseph said, from our bird's eye view, Alexander clearly brought massive changes to the geopolitical nature of the region. But how was it felt by the average person? Say you're just some random Egyptian or Babylonian peasant. Is this just meet the new boss, same as the old boss? And change was more felt on a generational timescale. Joseph, you've pretty much nailed it. Of course, if you were in the path of conquest, everybody would have to deal with that, and there were certainly economic ramifications to all the looting and warfare. But on a general social and political level, the ordinary people wouldn't have noticed much in Alexander's life. In part, there was even less change than a different conqueror might have caused, because Alexander spent so much time at war without ever really stopping to consolidate until the last few years of his life. There just wasn't a lot of opportunity in the first place for top-down change. Alexander also very consciously adopted Persian and Mesopotamian customs and tried to disrupt day-to-day life as little as possible. Ancient sources tend to emphasize this as an infatuation with the East, but realistically, it was a strong political strategy, stronger than a lot of invading militaries have managed in recent history. Less disruption meant less motivation for resistance. So, much of the actual Hellenization of society and culture only occurred over the subsequent generations when Alexander's generals took power. And that is a process we will be seeing a lot of in the upcoming episodes. Joseph also asked, what's with all the tomb raiding while Alexander was in Central Asia and India? Was this just general lawlessness? Or did Macedonians writ large just really not give a damn about Persian burial practices? Well, the arrival of Lara Croftia probably didn't help very much. But in all seriousness, this is a bit of column A and a bit of column B. Royal and noble tombs were full of valuable grave goods, and people wanted all that gold and finery. That goes for Macedonians, Greeks, Thracians, and even other Iranians. Outside of the largest and grandest tombs like Naqsh-e-Rustam, that were difficult to reach without some significant effort, this probably wasn't something done by the government so much as just individual soldiers and peasants seeing an opportunity and taking it. And you can see the same phenomenon in other parts of the world. Many, many ancient tombs were plundered while their cultures were still thriving. Egypt, famously, saw this happen all the time, despite their religion's nominal reverence for the death and the underworld. People still went in and robbed the pharaoh's tombs because they were full of shiny stuff. The invading armies, in this case, also had the aspect of claiming the loot by right of conquest. Local customs, as you said, be damned. Another question from JV, who was wondering if I plan to do an episode on Sino-Persian relations, similar to the one I did on India. JV said that he knows it's probably a little early in the Achaemenid world, but he's fascinated to hear about it. especially since there is a detailed description of Persia in the Shiji and Book of Han. So for anybody not following, Sino-Persian refers to Chinese-Persian relationships, and the answer is absolutely. The Meet the Neighbors series will be a recurring feature for the rest of the podcast. I will check back in with India, the new kingdoms that will pop up over the course of this next year, and plenty of others as we intersect with more and more cultures in the history of Persia. China specifically will show up in about 200 years of narrative when the Chinese diplomat Zhang Qian reaches Bactria, and they will become a recurring feature of foreign relations for the rest of the show thereafter. Without getting too much into it, in a sense, this podcast will actually end in China. Now, we come to a question about me, from somebody who I cannot make anonymous by just reading initials or screen names, or leaving out their surname, because there is no way to say that this person isn't me. I can't say Trevor asks. I can't say that a history podcaster named Trevor asks. I can't say that Trevor C. asks. So instead, I will trade that anonymity for some promotion. This is a question about podcasting and my experience from Trevor Callahan of the History of the Celts podcast, which I hadn't heard of because it's relatively new still, but I listened to a few episodes and do recommend you check it out. The people of Interior Europe during antiquity are an extremely fascinating bunch, and it's awesome to see somebody doing a podcast about that. But Trevor's question was, in my initial days of releasing the podcast, did I have imposter syndrome related to being new on the block, or not feeling qualified enough to host a podcast like mine, this one, that you're hearing right now? If so, have I ever gotten over that imposter syndrome, and how did I do it? Absolutely, 100%. I was still finishing my undergrad, felt totally unqualified. Indie history podcasting is a crowded place. Podcasting is a stupidly crowded place. And it's easy to see the big names with hundreds of episodes and hundreds of thousands of followers and feel like you don't belong. The answer is, you do belong, and fortunately, history podcasters tend to be a pretty welcoming bunch. I found a community and I made friends in this community, and everyone has been so supportive that it's hard to feel like I don't belong. And meeting these people and learning about them, and through that, becoming enmeshed in this community where we gossip and talk and whatever else about one another, you realize that with all of these giant history podcasts, these history of whole civilization sort of deals, a ton of us doing them aren't actually credentialed in any meaningful way. And a significant portion of us only got any sort of credentialing after getting started. One of the biggest things I've learned, both through starting and stopping grad school and becoming part of the broader public history of ancient Iran cohort of people, I guess, online, is that credentials just make the skills official. It is not impossible to learn how to do history really well on your own. It's just made easier with some sort of institutional training to back you up. On the academic end of things, there were two big moments that I think really calmed my imposter syndrome. One, I got to a point where I'd done enough episodes and enough research that I started catching errors and having nuanced disagreements with historians that I was reading. Most PhDs don't actually study history in the way that listening to this podcast is studying history. they pick specific related topics and get really, really granular with that interest. But even in their field, they don't necessarily have a phenomenal understanding of every step or aspect of culture. I am not an expert on everything about the Achaemenids. But by about episode 50, I did start to realize that I was well-read. The other thing was interacting with scholars on social media, both Reddit's Ask Historians and on Twitter, and being able to engage directly and even provide input, questions, or critiques that these people with the credentials took seriously. Basically, my advice is keep going, start getting to know people who already do public history, and eventually you will feel like part of the club. The other thing, which isn't as universally relevant to all history topics, but you might get some of this with the history of the Celts, is hearing from Iranian listeners, both in the diaspora and in Iran itself, and having those people make comments about how much they are learning about their own culture or how much they appreciate me making their culture more visible. If you're one of those people who feels that way or especially someone who has reached out in that way, genuinely, every time I get a message like that, I'm still shocked, and I've been getting them now for about 5 years. Realizing that you have an impact is a huge motivator for doing work like this. Another good one from Alex, where my answer written out ended up being almost as long as the full question in context, Alex said, after listening to episode 116, the level of resistance and rebellion that Alexander faced in the Northeast was really striking. I recall you mentioning some rebel activity in Anatolia and the Levant, but it sounded much more ephemeral by comparison. Do we have any indication that there were similar levels of rebellion in other areas, and maybe they just weren't focused on as much because Alexander moved through them quickly and left others to deal with it? Or do you think there was something in particular about the Northeastern Empire that made it particularly difficult to pacify? To start, the rebellions in Anatolia and the sort of tri-mountain intersection of the Taurus, Caucasus, and Zagros Mountains were by no means ephemeral, which we will deal with more in episodes going forward. The Persian rulers of Cappadocia and Armenia were still holding out when Alexander died, and new waves of rebellion pushed into western Anatolia repeatedly in the first several years of Alexander's campaign. It's why they get brought up briefly in several episodes. The problem is that our sources just focus too tightly on Alexander himself. Anything else is just footnotes by comparison. Even the last great campaign of Sparta against the Macedonians going on at the same time is just background noise. There's not much evidence for revolt in the Imperial Heartland or Eastern Iran, and it's hard to say what to make of that. Partly, Alexander invaded and crushed locally raised armies there after the rest of the empire had been cut off, so there were just fewer bodies available for revolt, and there was no institutional source dragging his attention away. But, once again, the sources are tightly focused on Alex himself, and they are notably more abbreviated in all their discussion of Alexander's campaign through Iran. So it is certainly possible that there was a greater level of resistance, and it's just not documented. Think about the difference in detail we had between something like the Battle of Gaugamela versus the battles Alexander fought in places like Drangiana and Ericosia. It's night and day. One of the theories I put forward in those episodes when I talked about his movement through Iran was that there was such significant resistance that they didn't like to talk about it. I think there is also something unique about the Northeast, where the only semi-settled nature of the local cultures enabled them to move around and fight in ways that the Macedonians just weren't used to facing. And the fact that the Achaemenids had been crushed. After Darius and Bessus were gone, there was an element of both every man for himself, trying to carve out your own little kingdom, and that they were the last front. There was no army that was ever going to come back them up. And I think that probably spurred more immediate reaction. Alex also had the related question about the level of brutality Alexander seemed to start exhibiting in the Northeast never really seemed to go away, even after he moved on to India. Do the sources offer any explanation for this, and or do I have a sense as to why? Ancient authors have two explanations. The first is the usual nonsense about Alexander becoming too Persianized and acting like an Eastern despot. This is obviously rooted in stereotypes and doesn't even reflect the actual actions of the Achaemenids before him. The other is usually alcoholism. Almost every detailed source on Alexander talks about how he became more and more intoxicated and prone to drunken rages as the campaign wore on. And I would suggest that this mixed with delusions of grandeur, buying into his own hype after defeating Darius, and probably a healthy dose of cognitive trauma from being in battle all his life, Alexander began to treat any resistance as rebellion rather than resistance to invasion. And about midway through the war in Sogdia, several sources, especially Curtius, emphasize how Alexander thought of himself as a living god. So rebellion was treated as resistance to the divine, and that meant treated harshly. On the cognitive side of things, this is diagnosing the past, which is always a dicey prospect, and you have to take in account that we don't see the same level of paranoia or psychosis from other people who fought in all of the same battles. But I think there is probably a case to be made that Alexander the Great could have had CTE, and that would explain some of his more dramatic personality shifts. Especially if you mix it with heavy drinking and narcissism. And on that note, I think I'm going to call it for part one of this AMA. Because of the delays in recording, these will probably drop back to back, either same day or one day after the next. But I think this helps break up your listening as much as it helps break up my recording. So next time, join me with more questions and more answers. And until then, if you want more information about this podcast, you can go to historyofpersiapodcast.com. That's where you will find my bibliography, the Achaemenid family tree, and plenty of other things, including the support page, to financially support this project. There are all sorts of ways to do that, but most importantly, there's patreon.com/historyofpersia. You can sign up for a monthly subscription ranging from $1 to $20, and access to things like ad-free listening, bonus episodes, and discounted merchandise. Even if you don't want to subscribe, you can also visit the show's store, either through historyofpersiapodcast.com or historyofpersia.launchcart.com. You can also support this show for free by leaving a rating or review on your podcast app of choice. I always love to see your feedback, but even better than that, tell your friends to listen to the History of Persia. Share it on social media at History of Persia Podcast on Facebook, Instagram, and Threads, and just History of Persia on Twitter, and everything else that's trying to be Twitter. Thank you all so much for listening to The History of Persia.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Welcome to Prime Video's Culture-Rated Collection. This is the place where Black is the main character, where we don't jump through hoops just to hear our voice and can fall in love with illuminating documentaries like Giannis, The Marvelous Journey.
I'm just a hard worker that's trying to survive.
Enjoy the animated series, The Second Best Hospital in the Galaxy.
All doctors report immediately!
Where we dive into something new like the latest season of Them, The Scare, and the award-winning American Fiction.
Welcome home, baby!
Or add to the experience by buying or renting the biopic of a legend, Bob Marley, One Love.
I want my music to unify people.
And add on channels like Paramount Plus and Stars to bask in nostalgia with Beverly Hills Cop.
This is the cleanest police car I've ever been in my life.
And BMF.
You're about to take over the whole nation.
Explore Prime Video's culture-rated collection and enjoy old school greats and new school hits. Prime Video. Find your happy place. Restrictions apply. See Amazon.com/AmazonPrime for details.